Blog Talk Radio.
Pour yourself a cup of tea, put your feet up, and relax. Show host Randy Fine, narcissistic abuse expert, compassionate counselor for clients worldwide, and author of the groundbreaking new book, Close Encounters of the Worst Kind, invites you into her sanctuary, a place where your emotional, physical, and spiritual well-being are all that matters. Time to Heal is a fundraising single written and performed by Johnny Z for the Amy Winehouse Foundation. For more information, please go to johnnymusic.com, johnnymusic.com. And now, it's time to meet Randy, show host of the podcast enjoyed by fans around the globe, A Fine Time for Healing.
Good morning. Thank you for tuning in to listen to A Fine Time for Healing. This is your show host, Randy Fine. Are you feeling overwhelmed, stressed, and maybe like there isn't enough time or energy to get everything done? Well, today's special guest, Dr. Tamsin Astor, the author of the book Force of Habit, Unleash Your Power Through Healthy Habits, teaches us how to create a life of joy and freedom by making connections in your daily habits, thereby reducing your decisions. Tamsin Astor, PhD, helps busy professionals organize themselves so they have time for what they need and want, and time for fun. She is your chief habit scientist, wrangling your habits around sleep, exercise, and eating through a lens of mindfulness and relationship management. Excuse me, I'm a little hoarse today. So let me introduce you and we'll get started. Good morning, Dr. Astor. How are you?
Good morning. Very well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
It's such a pleasure to have you. I really appreciate it. So your book, Force of Habit, basically, tell us what this basically is about.
So this book is came out of my own personal experience and then the trainings that I did in yoga and Ayurveda and executive coaching and health coaching with my background in psychology and neuroscience, which is what my PhD is in. And it's really about helping people create connections between their daily habits, so that it creates more time and energy for the stuff they have to do, the stuff they need to do, the stuff they want to do, and for fun. Because we make, 35,000 decisions or so every day, and we get decision fatigue. So as we get more overwhelmed, we're more likely to make unhealthy decisions. So the main focus of this book and the work that I do with my clients is on helping people create connections between the habits that they do every day, when they sleep, when they eat, when they exercise, when they have date nights, when they meditate, when they create time for their important relationships, so that they have more time and energy to do everything else, and they're not making little decisions every day about when am I going to eat, what am I going to eat, when am I going to go to the gym, when am I going to have a date night, when am I going to blah, blah, blah.
We all kind of do that, don't we? So you talk about the shoulds. What do you mean when you talk about the shoulds? What do we do with that?
Well, the shoulds are, they come out of this idea from psychology of we have the ought self, the ideal self, and the real self. So our real self is, I'm a white woman who's 42, I have 3 children, I live in Cleveland, I grew up in London, right? So those are the real characteristics of myself. Then I have my shoulds, my oughts. You know, I ought to weigh this much. I ought to look like this. I ought to love kale. I ought to, you know, have the newest Lululemon yoga pants when I do my down dog. I ought. And then there's the ideal. You know, what gets me really excited about life? What gets me really turned on? What kind of legacy do I want to leave? What am I passionate about? And it's really easy, particularly as women and as mothers, to get stuck into the shoulds of, you know, I ought to do this, I should do this. And they can become this overbearing sort of dominating force in our life, which leaves little room for the good stuff.
Okay, yeah. Yes, we do that. It's very hard to get out of that pattern of the expectations mm-hmm. we have for ourselves that we think everyone has for us. But really, mm-hmm. they're self-imposed, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, our greatest freedom comes when we really start to realize that it's not our business what other people think of us.
Yes, that is so true. And, you know, I find that, you know, when I work with my clients and I release them from that, often they'll say to me, really, I don't have to? I don't have to do this mm-hmm. and I don't have to do that? I'm like, no. Why do you think you
mm-hmm.
do?
mm-hmm.
But we sometimes need permission to be released mm-hmm. from what we think the expectations of us are. So you bring
Absolutely.
A lot of theories into this book, and one of them is this concept of, let's see, prajnaparada. Okay. What is that? It's a long word. What is the where does this come from, and what is it?
It's a Sanskrit word that I came across when I was doing my first Ayurveda training. And Ayurveda is the sister science to yoga. It means the science of life. Ayurveda, that's what the word means. And prajnaparadaha is a crime against wisdom. So it's when you do something that you know is not smart. So it's having that third glass of wine when you know if you drink three glasses, you're not going to sleep well or you're going to have a hangover. It's that, you know, having that extra slice of pizza. It's having that donut that somebody at the office brought in. It's doing that thing that you know is not smart, right? It's that crime against wisdom. And the way I present it in my book and to my clients is, you know, one of the things that's really key, and you introduced me as the chief habit scientist, is I try to encourage people to become their own habit scientists, to really start to learn what works for me, what suits me, what doesn't work. And so with this concept of prajnaparadaha, it's, you know I can do this and I can survive, or I can do better, or I can thrive. And sometimes we might knowingly go into a situation, creating a crime, right? We might go, you know what, I'm going to go and hang out with my kids and I'm going to eat a whole lot of pizza and I'm going to, you know, just break this rule that I know generally I do better when I don't eat cheese or gluten or tomato or whatever it is, you know. But I'm going into it with my eyes open, so I know then I'm going to create some other habits around that to ameliorate it.
And so you say a more formal framework for this can be provided by the framework known as the Purusharthas. And so this is Dharma, Kama, and Moksha. What are these, and how do they relate to our habits?
So the Purusharthas are the four aims, defined as the soul's aims. And this is something that I help my clients go through. So, you know, when we think about stepping back, we need to look back. Sometimes, you know, when I do this to my clients, we get into the nitty-gritty, what I call like the microscopic stage of habit shifting, right? So we're getting into the habits and we may be saying, okay, we're going to start going to bed and getting up at 5 a.m., and we're going to get going to the gym and meditating. And then after a while, you might think, well, why the hell am I doing this? This is so not fun. I want to be, you know, watching Netflix until 2 in the morning and then getting up at 8 and going to Dunkin' Donuts. And then you need to step back. And what the Purusharthas are about doing what I call the telescopic part of self-growth, where you step back and you look at the overall frame for why you want to make these changes, why these healthy habits are important for you. And the four habits are, the four aims are dharma, karma, artha, and moksha. So dharma is your life's purpose. What are you here to do? And it could be more than one thing. It could be I'm here to be the greatest mother I can be and to create a change in the lives of people around me in a positive way. Then the second artha is financial wellness. You know, what am I doing in my life to create financial well-being? You know, is that living a debt-free life? Is that saving in a 401k? Is this having enough money to send my kids to college? Like, what does that look like? Is it having organic food delivered to me? And then we have Kama, K-A-M-A, like Kama Sutra, and that's pleasure, right? We are sensual beings, and often we can get stuck in this sort of Protestant work ethic framework of I can only have pleasure after I've, you know, checked off the boxes. And I really encourage my clients to frame their days around pleasure. Like, what does pleasure look like? And so for me, you know, one of the reasons I love being a life coach and an author is that I can take my kids to school. I can take my dog for a walk in the middle of the day. I can sit and eat my own yummy food in my backyard and still, you know, make a living and have the life I want. And then the final one is moksha, which is freedom. And for some, that's a religious or spiritual freedom, and it's being connected into that, into the broader scheme of things. For others, it's community and being connected in your local community. Others, it's, for me, you know, time freedom is a big driving force for me. I like to be able to structure my days so that I can go and spend a month in Europe with my family so that I can, as I said, pick up my kids from school and walk my dog in the middle of the day. So when we get stuck in the nitty-gritty of the habits and we're thinking, why am I eating kale? Why am I going to the gym at 5 a.m? We step back and we look at what are the bigger whys behind that.
Exactly. I get it. Excuse me. So, while we're talking about the Ayurvedic principles and everything, let's talk about the energetic principles, the doshas, what they're about. You know, years ago, I went on an Ayurvedic diet. I saw an Ayurvedic doctor, and so I learned a little bit about this, but it's been a while, so I don't really remember too much about the principles, but I know that you talk about them in your book, so let's talk to everybody about that.
So there's the general principles and then the specific principles. Often when we do our online dosha test or we go and see a doctor, we're talking about the specific principles of our own unique constitution. And the doshas are, as you said, organizing principles. So we have vata, pitta, and kapha. Vata is air and space. Pitta is fire and water, and kapha is earth and water. And these organizing principles go through our, you know, our physical and mental well-being. So when we go to doctors and we do our online dosha tests, we're looking at our own unique constitution, and we've all got a mix of these. And it really works on a principle of opposites. So taking myself as an example, I'm high in vata, which is air and space, which means I have a tendency towards, you know, being ungrounded and all over the place, which is probably what attracted me to this work, where I have that sense of freedom in my day, but I'm, you know, I construct rituals and routines to help keep me grounded, right? When I'm doing well, I'm outgoing and creative and I grasp ideas quickly. When I'm out of balance, I tend towards insomnia and anxiety and dry skin. So what do I need to do to balance that? I need, you know, heavy oily foods. I need good warm routines. I need nourishing ritualistic behaviors and treatments to keep me grounded. So we've got that specific constitution. So we've all got vata, pitta, and kapha in our physical and mental bodies. It's created at our birth. You know, when the egg and the sperm unite, that's when our prakriti, our constitution, is formed. And then what we're experiencing right now, our vikriti, is based on what the season is, how old we are, how much stress we're under, how we're eating, you know, whether we're overweight or underweight, what our relationships are like. So we have our natural constitution, and then we have where we are right now, depending on what's going on in our lives. So that's the angle of Ayurveda, which is something that's really great for people to dive into and explore and to understand deeply, and I explain in the book. So as you start to understand it, you can help structure your life. So again, you know, it's not just how you eat. So if you're high in vata like me, you will have a tendency to be very stimulated by, you know, watching TV shows and music and movies and arguments. So somebody who's high in vata cannot watch a Netflix violent show at 10 o'clock at night and then expect to have a good night's sleep. Whereas if you're high, right, so I mean, it's what you consume through all your senses, I guess is my point, you know? Whereas if you're high in kapha and you've got that earthy, watery energy, you can have a steaming, you can have a like large espresso, have an argument with your spouse and watch like an episode of like Peaky Blinders and fall into a deep nourishing sleep, you know? So it's about knowing that in yourself, and then you can create a life around that. And then we've got the general, which is, you know, what season are we in, right? So we're just coming out in the northern hemisphere of the pitta season, the summer season, the heat, right? We're moving into vata, which is fall, right? The leaves fall off the tree, the wind picks up. And then we move in when it snows and we get into deep winter, into kapha, when everything gets wet and quiet and dark and heavy and everything goes underground. So we cycle through the seasons during the year. We cycle through vata, pitta, and kapha. In our age, when we're born, we're in kapha stage. We're in a stage of massive growth. We have a tendency towards, you know, sinus infections and snotty, you know, think about snotty babies. And then we move into pitta. And, you know, we have acne and hormones and rage and, you know, teenage tension, you know, which I'm just getting now. I've got a 14 and almost 13-year-old. And then we move into the vata stage of life when we, you know, our skin gets drier, we need less sleep, we need less food, and, you know, we become less tied to the real world, to the physical world. And the vata, pitta, kapha also cycle through our days. So between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. is pitta time. The sun is high in the sky. Then we move into kapha time at the end of the day and pitta time. So we cycle through pitta and kapha during the day in these four-hour chunks. So it goes through the 12 o'clock cycle twice. And what we do and what we eat and how we behave is also largely determined by this. And again, dependent on your own specific constitution, you will be more sensitive to these things.
Interesting. So really, we have to accept who we are and what our individual tendencies are. So many people compare themselves to others, and they look at the way others act in their life, run their lives, what they do for a job, and they hold themselves as to those standards, even though it feels very uncomfortable. So we really have to accept these individual needs, tendencies, characteristics of who we are in order to structure our day, not really what everybody dictates to us, right?
Exactly. And that, I think, for me is one of the key lessons that Ayurveda can teach us is, you know, it's very easy, particularly with all the millennials, to make sort of fun of like the special snowflake. But Ayurveda really does demonstrate that we are all unique and we've all got these unique constitutions. And when you can understand how that works, you can then start treating yourself and engaging in the world in a way that makes your life so much easier because you're working with the energies rather than against them. So for example, you know, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., that's pitta time, right? We've got, in the Western speak would say, we've got the most bile in our digestive tract. So we're going to digest food most efficiently. Now, if you are somebody who has a lot of pitta in your constitution, you can eat a steak at 10 o'clock at night and sleep well. So you're less, you know, afflicted, as it were, by this time energy zones during the day. Whereas if you're high in vata like me and your digestive fire is not strong, you really want to be concentrating on eating your biggest meal in that window because you're going to digest the food most effectively and process it and then sleep well at night if you don't eat your biggest meal at the end of the day.
And you say in your book that there's somewhere on your website that we can go to sort of take a test and see what we are.
Yes, I've got a blog post where I give out the three dosha tests. You want to do more than one because it's the physical and the mental. Some of the tests tend towards more of the physical characteristics like your skin type, your hair type, your whether you're constipated or your digestive function, and some focus more on your mental attributes, which is why it's good to do more than one.
Right. And where do we go? What is your website? Where do we go to look at that?
It's my name, TamsinAster.com. And if you just Google TamsinAster dosha test, it'll come up on my blog.
Okay, perfect. So as you were talking about the seasons and how we should align ourselves with the seasons, I'm thinking to myself, well, I live in Florida. We don't have any seasons. So how does that affect us when we live in a climate like that that doesn't really, I mean, yes, it gets a little colder between November and May, but not cold, and we don't lose the leaves on our trees, and the vegetation and everything remains pretty much the same year round. So how does that affect us?
Some, Yeah, I mean, if you live somewhere where there aren't those big fluctuations, you're going to have less of an issue with them. And what you want to concentrate more is your own unique constitution and how you're living, you know, in accordance with that. Because when you are thinking about so an example I would give here, living in Northeast Ohio, right? In January, February, when there's snow on the ground, eating a salad and eating strawberries is not advised. Why? Because it's clearly not grown in your local environment, so it's traveled and is not going to be as nutritionally dense. Secondly, your system is struggling to stay warm, so giving it cold food that's going to require a lot more effort to digest is not clever, right? Whereas if you're in Florida in January, when you can probably still be wearing flip-flops and shorts, you can probably eat the strawberries. It would be the main driving understanding behind paying attention to that. Does that make sense?
Yes, it totally does. I mean, and in the summer here, when it's really, really hot and humid, all I want is salads. I just don't want anything heavy. You know? So
there
I think
you
if we pay
there's
attention to what our cravings are, you know, then
mm-hmm.
it really will tell
mm-hmm.
us. Yeah, and
mm-hmm.
as it gets a little colder, I get more into wanting soups and things like that. But,
mm-hmm.
but yeah,
mm-hmm.
I definitely have noticed that. How does stress play a role in all of this?
Stress is huge because, you know, when it builds up, we get into a situation where our system doesn't work effectively. So in the book, I talk about how we need to have a little bit of stress in our lives, otherwise we don't get stuff done. You know, I talk about like the fire under your backside, you know, to sort of, you know, kickstart, the kick's going on. And there's actually a great word for that, eustress, which is E-U-S-T-R-E-S-S, which actually means good stress. So when we are in a state of being in balance, we are aware of what good stress is. So that might be, you know, giving yourself a deadline, saying I'm going to make it to the gym 20 times out of every 30 days. You know, giving yourself a deadline, giving yourself some kind of routine, some kind of schedule, some kind of goal that feels a little bit uncomfortable, but ultimately doable, right? So when we get out of whack with that, one of the biggest problems I see with my clients is a buildup of cortisol. And cortisol, unlike adrenaline, takes 24 hours to break down. So adrenaline breaks down really quickly. And you've seen that, you know, if you've been in a car accident or you've broken a limb or you've been in a very stressful situation, the adrenaline, you know, masks the pain for a little bit and then it wears off because it has a short half-life. Whereas cortisol, because it takes 24 hours to break down, if you're having one moment of every day, you're basically living in a state of cortisol, like your whole system is flooded. Like one of my Ayurveda teachers, it was like you're living in a cortisol bath. You know, your whole entire body is flooded with cortisol. And what that means is that you are then compromising your immune function, and also cortisol contributes to putting on weight around the midsection. And while that might be a vanity issue for some of us, it's more concerning because the fat around the midsection is more metabolically active. And when you're putting fat that's more metabolically active around the liver, the kidney, the heart, the intestines, you're upping your potential rates for heart disease and cancer and a whole load of issues. So stress, learning how to manage stress is one of the most important things that I work with my clients on.
And you say, I like this, you say, feel that fight, flight, freeze system start to fire up, feeling that cortisol rise, breathe. It takes about 3 breaths to start pacifying the fight, flight, and for the cortisol to start dissipating. So really all we have to do is take 3 deep breaths when we catch ourselves
mm-hmm.
in that mode.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so part of it, again, is learning to be your own habit scientist. You're starting to notice, you know, oh my goodness, I'm getting out of whack, you know, and I'm, you know, reaching for the coffee, I'm getting angry, I'm getting sweaty, I'm getting, you know, and you're noticing all of these things. And the more you start to pay attention to, are there particular situations that create that in my life? You know, are there particular people? Are there particular events? Are there things coming up that I could potentially get rid of? And I often give this as a practice to my clients, like the 3 D's that I think some executive coach came up with for email, you know, do, delete, and delegate. I tell my clients to apply that to their life too. You know, so when it comes up, it's like, can you delete this thing from your life that is stressing you out? You know, is there a better way to do it? Or can you delegate this because it gives you so much stress and is not adding any benefit, and actually somebody else in your life can do it?
Mm. It seems so easy. What if, you know, I, it seems so easy, but yet, you know, it really, it's not a natural tendency. We really do have to pay attention to these things. We have to pay attention to how we're being affected by everything around us. We have to pay attention to that. Mm-hmm. What happens if you are, if we are in an environment, because, and this is what I deal with often is people who have emotional abuse situations. They're either in them, coming out of them, or have lived in them for a long time and are trying to heal from them. And when you're in these kind of situations and the cortisol is constantly, constantly, constantly flowing, how does that affect us long term?
So long term, you know, it affects our immune function. So, you know, there are a couple of things to do. One is, you know, I often use the analogy of the boiling frog. You know, when you are in a situation that is that becomes more abusive over time, it's really easy for you not to realize that that's what's happening, because it just incrementally gets worse and worse. And it's not until you're out of it that you really see it. Whereas if you threw somebody, you know, right into this deeply emotionally abusive situation, they would go, hell no, and jump right out. So one of the things that you can do to counteract that is to meditate. Because meditation has been shown to boost your immune function. So at the end of your strands of DNA is something called a telomere. And the more you meditate, the more you boost the telomerase, which facilitates the growth of the telomeres. So that improves your immune function. So that counteracts the negative effect of cortisol. So there are a few things to do. One is to meditate to boost your immune function, which counteracts that negative effect of cortisol. The second is to find a way of getting the cortisol out of us, right? So the cortisol and adrenaline in that fight-flight situation are normally there because they send the blood away from the heart, away from the digestive tract, and away from the brain, and make out towards our arms and legs so that we can fight or run, right?
Okay.
And most of the time these days, we're not fighting or running, right? We're dealing with verbal abuse, we're dealing with emails, we're dealing with crappy drivers, we're dealing with social media stuff, we're dealing with depressing news, stressful news. So it's all of this energy is building up and we're not dissipating it. So the other thing is that's really key is to get that energy out of your system. So, you know, I'm a big fan, I have a little one of those little mini trampolines, you know, so when me or my kids would get twirly, like go and jump on the trampoline, you know, take the dog for a walk, go for a run, go to a yoga class, take a taekwondo class, go and do something to get that physical energy out of you so it's not building up and accumulating. Because one of the problems is that when that cortisol builds up is that the blood goes away from our digestion, our digestive tract and our brain, which means that we end up making crappy decisions and we're not digesting our food well, which, you know, in the long term just contributes to all these problems and makes it worse.
Okay. How does our diet affect our habits and how we feel from day to day? I mean, obviously it does, but, you know, I mean, the Western diet is not so good, right?
So one of the biggest things I think that you know, has become clear, you know, recently and in the study of psychoneuroendocrinology, which is the study of, you know, hormones and how they make us feel, you know, in our psychological and neurological profiles, which fits with Ayurveda, which has been around for 6,000 years, which is often called kitchen science, which is that the majority of our serotonin is in our gut. And it's not in our brain, as the pharmaceutical companies will want you to believe and, you know, farm out the Prozac. The majority of our serotonin is in our gut. So what we eat massively affects who we are and how we feel and how we show up, which is why one of the first things that I encourage my clients to do if they're on a really crappy diet is to do some kind of cleanse where they just eat vegetables for a week or so, just to get the sugar and the carbs and the alcohol and the caffeine and the everything out of their system so that they can just go back to a baseline of what does food taste like and how does my body feel when I'm giving it straightforward fuel and not the whole load of processed, you know, easily digestible, high energy but low nourishing food. So food is massive and is often one of the most important starting places if you're feeling crappy about yourself and life.
And you have there's several pages in your book that give recipes for plant fuel for high vibe, mind, and body. So that's kind of cool. There's some cool things in here. Okay, so another thing I really want to talk about is this idea of self-love. And I try very much to explain that to those who have no concept of it. And I'd like to hear how you explain self-love and how we come to that, what the importance of it is and how we come to that when we really don't know what it is.
So I think, you know, one of the first things that I find helpful with people is I say to them, you know, when they start saying negative things about themselves, I say, would you say that to your best friend or your daughter, you know, or your mother, somebody that you love deeply? So I think we are often incredibly unkind to ourselves, and we using that as a very sort of basic rubric, you know, would I actually say that to somebody else? Is it, for me, is a very good catch. So for me, when I describe self-love to my clients, I say, you know, are you acting in accordance with your greater good? Are you doing things that you know serve you? So it feeds a little bit back into this idea of like prajnaparadaha, this sort of crime against wisdom. Are you doing things that serve you? Are you living in accordance with your greatest good? Do you know what makes you happy? Do you know what fulfills you? And are you doing things on a daily basis that add to that? And some of the things that are really key for coming into that space and cultivating that energy are to doing things for, you know, all parts of yourself. So are you moving in a way that fits your body, you know, or are you running 20 miles a week just because you, you know, don't want to put on the weight, but actually, you know, your ankles are hurting and your knees are hurting and you're getting blisters and it's not a good exercise for you. Are you eating food that nourishes you? Are you eating a salad every day because you desperately don't want to put on the weight, but actually you're constantly angry and starving and hungry? Are you talking to yourself in a loving way? Are you wearing clothes? Are you spending time with people who are what one of my coach and oldest friends describes? Are you hanging out with people who are radiators rather than drains? Are you hanging out with people who make you feel warm, who spread warm energy through you, who see you, who affirm you, who stimulate you, rather than those who drain you and make you feel exhausted? So some of those are some of the sort of components. You know, it's a physical and it's a mental approach to self-love is what I think.
Yeah, I mean, all that makes sense. It's funny, you know, I do this kind of silent thing to myself when, if I start beating myself up, you know, I do exactly kind of what you say. I say, you know, okay, so you're beating yourself up over this thing that happened. Would you beat up your, like you say, your children, your best friend over the same kind of thing? Would you do that to them? And then I say to myself, I go through this whole dialogue, no, I wouldn't do that to anyone else. Then stop doing it to you. And you know, it's kind of the same kind of thing. But, yeah, when we put it on other people, when we think about what we're saying to ourselves and ask ourselves, would we say that to other people? Would we try to abuse other people the way we abuse ourselves? It really sort of helps us to understand what we're doing to ourselves. And so you talk about avoiding toxic people in your book. And again, that's right up my alley here. So what do we do? You know, we get hung up on titles and relationships and things like that. What do we do when the toxic people in our lives are our relatives?
Which often
happens.
Right. So, I mean, you know, one of the things that I suggest for my clients is to reduce the valency of the interaction with them. So, you know, again, it's that thing of, you know, if this is somebody that, you know, you normally see regularly in person, instead, reduce that to talking on the phone. If there's somebody that you talk on the phone to, can you reduce it to email or text? Is there some way that you can reduce the valency of the connection with that person? So that's one thing I suggest to people. You know, is there a way of reducing their physical or energetic presence in your interactions with them? Another is to just, you know, really consider whether you need to maintain this relationship. You know, because sometimes, again, we get stuck in the thing of this, you know, this is my, you know, my mother-in-law, my, you know, my sibling's partner or whoever it is who's, you know, who is creating this energy in your life. And you think, you know, is it possible to maintain relationships with the other people and not with this person? Because, you know, I love that Jim Rohn quote, we're the average of the five people we spend time with, most time with. And if these people are people that you are spending a lot of time with, but they are, you know, exhausting and draining and, you know, maybe they're on the narcissistic personality disorder continue, maybe you want to not be in that energetic space. So I think, you know, it's very easy to get stuck in this idea of the shoulds again. Like, I should have my, you know, so-and-so to lunch every Sunday, even though, you know, every time they leave, I feel exhausted and humiliated and violated because of the way they've, you know, talked about my home or my children or my parenting or whatever.
Right. And boundaries are part of this, right?
Mm-hmm. Hugely so, yeah.
So I'm just kind of going through this book because there's so much in here. This is a great book. There's so much in here to grab onto. Many tips and just many approaches to this. Gratitude. You say, this, my friends, is a biggie. Such a biggie that I have the word tattooed on my inner right wrist to remind me to be grateful. Why is this such a biggie?
It's a biggie for a number of reasons. One is that when you start cultivating a gratitude practice, the people around you report you as being happier and nicer to live with and, you know, more engaged in life. Secondly, when you start to practice gratitude, you are training your brain to look for the good in the world. So if you take the practice of writing your gratitudes down, you can get 3 dopamine hits from every event. So you start to look for the things, and then you see that beautiful tulip, and you get that dopamine burst of, oh, that tulip. And then you, at the end of the day, you write down, I saw this beautiful tulip on my walk today. So you get another dopamine hit. And then if you go back at the end of the week and read through your gratitudes for that week, you're getting a third dopamine hit. So one of the things it does is it really cultivates that shift in how you engage with the world, what you're looking for, what you're prioritizing. And the other thing is that it boosts your energy. Often when we get into a state of depletion, it's because we are doing things that are stressful, we're doing things that are tough, we're hanging out with people that are exhausting, we haven't figured out how to manage our stress. And gratitude practices are basically a really good way of sort of filling your energetic cup, as it were, so that when you have that thing that comes up, that deadline, that stressful event, that whatever it is, fill in the gap, you've got an energetic basis from this practice of gratitude from which to draw, right? So it's like your savings account, as it were.
Right. I mean, I definitely believe in it. For me, it changed everything. When I focus on gratitude, my life is more abundant. It just, it's the secret, the law of attraction, all those kind of things. But there is really, there's a lot of truth to it.
Mm. It's about shifting your mindset into looking for that silver lining, right? You know,
right.
So a classic concrete example from my life is my middle child is a cancer survivor, and he just reached 10 years clear, which was amazing, and it was so happy. But, you know, that was a horrible process. But there were a couple of really huge silver linings that came out of it. One was that he was massively allergic to every kind of nut, and the chemotherapy rebooted his immune system, and now he's only allergic to 2 kinds of nuts, they produce hives rather than anaphylaxis. So this is huge. Like, he still has to carry an EpiPen, but, you know, if he ends up with a walnut in something, he gets hives. He doesn't go into anaphylaxis, you know, because the chemotherapy rebooted. So that, you know, like, who knew? Like, we didn't want to put any 2-year-old kid through, and, you know, through chemotherapy, but woohoo! Like, is that, you know? So there are these things that come out of these horrible events, you know, that are positive. So that's another thing too, for gratitude, is that you're constantly thinking, what is the learning in the situation? What can I be grateful for? How can I reframe this? What's the good from this situation?
Right. We really have to do that. It's so easy to fall into the funk of, you know, oh, woe is me, and, you know, I hate this and I hate that. But really, if we grab on to the good things in life, we feel so much better. I wanted to ask you, before we were talking about meditation, I wanted to ask you, is once a day, because I used to do TM, okay, and I know that they recommend 20 minutes twice a day.
Mm-hmm.
If we meditate once a day, is that sufficient? How often do you recommend we meditate?
So, again, if it's a new habit that you're cultivating, I just say start by doing 5 minutes every day. Because when you are starting a new habit, you want to make it doable, or as John Assaraf says, you know, reduce it to the ridiculous so that you can't avoid it, you know. And often if we make it too big of a commitment, we fall away. So I start by saying, just do it 5 minutes every day. And then you'll start to find that actually you want to do it for more than that. You know, same with yoga. I'm just like, do 5 sun salutations every day and then get on with your day. And then after a while, you'll be like, no, I want to do it for 30 minutes. I want to do it for an hour. So start by making it something that you can do and commit to. And I see this often with my new clients. They get really excited and they're like, I'm going to add like 20 new habits this week. And I'm like, no, back off. You. Just start with one or two, you know.
One,
so,
right.
You know, because that's what I generally say with meditation. And willpower is like a muscle and it fatigues. So generally when we're adding a new habit, I really encourage my clients to do it earlier in the day rather than later in the day, particularly if they, you know, if they've got kids and family, or they've got a job where they're, you know, they get home and then they're on their email for another 2 or 3 hours every night, because suddenly it's 11 o'clock at night and you're exhausted and you haven't done your meditation or your gratitude journaling or your yoga practice or whatever it is that you've decided to commit to as your new habit. So one of the things I'll say is try and get it done, you know, in the earlier part of the day, and then build from there. And once you've got that habit committed and sustained and you're doing it regularly, then, you know, double the time or add in that second time, you know, at the end of the day or whatever. But the start and the end of the day are great places for meditation, because they are about, you know, slowing down. And at the beginning of the day, it's great because you haven't started to engage in the world yet. So you're kind of setting your own internal frame for how am I going to approach this day. And at the end of the day, it's about, you know, letting go of what's gone on that day. And you'll find, you know, as you meditate, you know, stuff from the past will come up and stuff in the future. And you just sit there and you let it go and you sort of cool yourself before you go to sleep.
Right. It kind of resets you too if you're kind of in the middle of a stressful situation, then you just take that time. So before we run out of time, to my listeners, we're talking to Tamsin Astor, Dr. Tamsin Astor, about her book, Force of Habit, Unleash Your Power by Developing Great Habits. So where do we purchase your book? Is it Amazon and the usual places?
Yes,
okay.
Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You can get it in paperback or in electronic form, yeah.
Oh, perfect. Okay. Wow, it's been great talking to you. This time went so fast. It always does. But we have so much to talk about. But it's been really wonderful having you. Thank you so much, Tamsin.
Thank you. I appreciate so much. I get excited to share all of this work. So thank you for the great questions, which allowed me to riff on all of the fun stuff I share in my book.
Sure. I like to get around in there and make sure we touch on all the important stuff. So good. I'm glad that you felt that that we covered a lot. Well, I wish you a wonderful day. And
thank you.
Thanks again. Take care.
Thank you so much.
We hope you enjoyed today's programming. To learn more about Randy Fine, read her articles, or to make a counseling appointment with her, please visit randygfine.com. That's RANDIGFINE.com. Or visit her on Facebook at Randy G. Fine.